This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Chris Berrow, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 1st of September, these are our main stories. The United Nations is to begin a mass polio vaccination campaign in Gaza. A weight loss drug shows signs of helping with a number of other serious medical conditions. And the unusual royal wedding in Norway between a princess and a shaman. Also in the podcast...
I remember Googling how to teach an armless man how to shoot a bow. And there was nothing online on how to do it, so I had to teach myself.
We'll meet the so-called armless archer competing at this year's Paralympic Games and a preview of a documentary featuring the Canadian rock band that united a nation through song. A mass polio vaccination campaign begins in earnest today in the Gaza Strip. The move was made possible because Israel and Hamas have agreed to what they call localised pauses in the fighting. These parents were among the first to get their children immunised.
Given the overpopulation of displaced people and the spread of polluted, undrinkable water and sewage on the streets, this poses a great danger to our children, especially given the appearance of the first case of polio in Gaza. The families were afraid, and I was afraid for my child, who's 11 months old. I even came today to give him the vaccination as part of this campaign.
I'm glad that my daughter received the vaccination. God willing, I will have all my children vaccinated. And may God keep the disease away from us and end this siege.
So just how bad is the situation in Gaza? Our correspondent Yolan Nell has this report.
Just two drops. As the UN begins vaccinating against polio in Gaza, a dose is easy to give. But carrying out a mass immunisation campaign here is a huge challenge. Parents of the first vaccinated children, like Maru Al-Kot, say they're relieved.
I was worried and afraid because this is scary, the polio disease. This disease makes the children unable to move.
Naveen Abujadian looks back at a video of her baby. He began crawling early. But now, she worries, he'll never be able to walk. Abdul Rahman was the first child found to have polio in Gaza in 25 years, and it paralysed his leg. Because of the war, he wasn't vaccinated, and now his mum says he has limited access to medical care.
Abud wants to live and be treated. He wants to live and walk like other children. I feel a lot of guilt that he didn't get the vaccination, but I couldn't give it to him because of our circumstances.
Displaced five times, the Abujadian family now lives in a crowded tent camp in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Raw sewage flows through streets nearby. In such insanitary conditions, diseases can spread easily, and polio is highly infectious. Since discovering the virus, UN agencies have been racing to set up an emergency mass vaccination program. And with war raging, they've agreed three localized three-day pauses in fighting with Israel and Hamas. Jonathan Cricks, local spokesman for UNICEF, tells me this is crucial.
You cannot lead and implement a polio vaccination campaign in an active combat zone. It's simply impossible. Families need to be feeling safe in bringing their babies, their children to get the vaccines. But also the healthcare workers need to be able to safely reach the communities.
When it comes to having the rollout, why is it so important to have it over a short time frame?
We are aiming to have 640,000 children below the age of 10 vaccinated in just a few days in the Gaza Strip. For the vaccination campaign to be efficient, for the transmission to be stopped, we need to reach at least 90% of these 640,000 children. Without that, there is a risk that the virus would mutate and that the transmission could continue.
Children make up nearly half the population of Gaza, and the past year has deprived many of their loved ones, their homes and health. With no end in sight to the war, the hope is that at least one new source of suffering can be eliminated.
Yolan Nell. The story dominating the front pages of many of Britain's newspapers this weekend is research suggesting that the weight loss jab semaglutide can be used to reduce the severity of other serious illnesses. And some health experts claim that the drug, branded as Ozempic or Wegovy, could also slow down the ageing process. Dr. Jeremy Samuel Faust from Harvard Medical School has seen the study. He told Stephen Nolan more about it.
What we learned last year was that for people with heart disease, these drugs can actually decrease mortality from all causes, cardiovascular disease. And then the surprise was non-cardiovascular diseases. That led investigators to look into whether some of these deaths had been COVID deaths. And it turned out that patients who'd been on semaglutide for a couple of years when the COVID pandemic started, actually, when they went on to get COVID-19, died about a third less than the people who'd been on placebo during that time. So it has some pretty important clinical effects. You know, the big one, I think, is appetite suppression. It slows down the rate of the stomach kind of pushing things forward into the small intestine. And that just makes people want to eat less. And when they eat less, their metabolic demands really change. And over time, that has tremendous health benefits.
Their metabolic demands, is that fancy talk for hunger?
No, not exactly. Hunger is what drives us just to eat. And if we eat too much, our body has to process that. And so our metabolic rate changes to process all of the calories coming into our body. So if we overeat, that leads to buildup of all kinds of inflammation, which can cause heart disease, can cause kidney disease, can cause diabetes. These drugs do the opposite. They say, look, we're full. Therefore, over time, how much energy we are burning, how much we're taking in goes down. And as a result of that, these inflammatory pathways that can cause all these various diseases is reduced dramatically.
There are risks with most drugs. What are the side effects?
First of all, I'll say with any drug, there are benefits and there are possible side effects. And we always want to balance those. And with these compounds, I will say I'm unusually encouraged because we keep seeing that the benefits are incredibly important ones. Decreased heart attacks, decreased mortality, now even COVID mortality reduced. These are incredible benefits. Now, nothing comes without a risk. We have from these trials, and we have also from observational data afterwards, that the most common side effect is nausea, gastrointestinal discomfort, mostly during the early phases. So people can get inflammation of the pancreas. This is not pancreatic cancer. It's just a pancreatitis. That seems to have been a little higher in people who took this drug. And sometimes people will have other conditions, like their intestines temporarily stop pushing things through. But again, these are self-limited. We haven't seen any major side effects that would cause alarm when on the other side of the ledger is a decrease in heart attacks, is a decrease in mortality.
Have they been around long enough for us to be confident in terms of the danger? You know, do we know enough about these drugs?
I think that with any drug, we want to see long-term follow-up. What we have so far is quite a bit more than usual for a quote-unquote blockbuster, because these drugs have been around in earlier generations for diabetes. So we've been seeing for over a decade now, these patients do quite well. Who's to say that 30 years from now, something might not crop up? But what's so unusual here is that right now, the benefit is not some decrease in something like your cholesterol level, and who knows what that means, or your blood pressure level, which you'd like it to be lower, but who knows what that adds to your daily risk. The benefits we're seeing in certain patients is life or death. They don't die as much. So if 30 years from now, it turns out that there's some increase in something that we don't like, that'll have a very steep climb to overcome all the benefits today. So I'm unusually optimistic. That doesn't mean that something's not going to crop up. And the caveat, of course, is that if there are patients who wouldn't benefit from this in the same way, they won't have that mortality benefit because they're already fairly healthy. Then what you're doing is you're putting those people at risk because, as you say, who's to say 20 years from now what will happen to people who take it? And if their lives weren't saved, what did they get? So that's a very important thing that we're watching.
That was emergency medicine specialist Dr. Jeremy Samuel Faust. In Hinduism, cows are revered as a symbol of unselfish giving, motherhood, and strength. Cows are often seen roaming freely amongst the traffic of busy roads and streets. Eating meat, and specifically beef, is considered by some to be offensive. In India, railway officials are investigating a video which has gone viral showing an elderly man being assaulted on a train because he's believed to be carrying a jar of beef. The details from Lipika Pelham.
The video shows the man with the white beard wearing a long traditional Islamic shirt surrounded by about a dozen young men in a train compartment. Some of them hit him around the face, asking him to show what he is carrying. Others hurl abuse. Some ask for his mobile phone. The man who's clutching a jar appears disorientated. Railway police said they have identified the victim as Haji Ashraf Munir from Jalgaon district in Maharashtra and also some of the men involved in the assault. Indian media say a number of suspects have been detained after a police team visited Haji Munir's home and recorded his statement. The investigation continues. Cows are sacred in Hinduism, and there have been frequent attacks by hardline Hindu groups on people accused of killing the animals for meat. The sale and consumption of beef are restricted in some parts of India by local governments, but Hindu nationalists have been demanding a complete nationwide ban on the slaughter of cows.
Now, it's the first weekend of the Paralympics in Paris, and archery is one of the sports taking centre stage. One of the athletes is Matt Stutzman of the United States, affectionately known as the Armless Archer. He was born without arms and competes by using his mouth to pull back the bowstring while holding the main bow with his foot. The 41-year-old holds a world record for the longest accurate shot. Our sports presenter, Nishat Lada, wanted to know what made Matt decide to take up archery.
I remember this very clearly. 2010, I was a stay-at-home dad. I can't find a job. I go apply places and nobody hires me. I had one person tell me if I had prosthetic arms, he would hire me. And I remember that day going home and thinking, like, I just need somebody to give me a chance. How am I going to put food on the table for my kids? And as I'm sitting there on TV, a guy is shooting a bow. And my brain said, Matt, do that. And I'm like, okay. So I remember Googling how to teach an armless man how to shoot a bow. And there was nothing online on how to do it. So I had to teach myself.
And you won silver at the London 2012 Paralympic Games, didn't you? So what is your goal for Paris? Can you take the next step perhaps to a gold medal?
I believe my skill is there to win a medal. But what's amazing about this games for me is that I call it the history games. That's because my family is here for the first time. They will be supporting me. They'll be in the stands. My boys, first time for them flying on a plane, an international trip. And on top of that, there are three other armless people at this event competing that I have helped get here. So for me, it's not necessarily about winning a gold medal. It's about doing my best and making memories. And if it works out that I shoot good and I win a medal, then that's just a bonus.
You live in Iowa, and I understand you've been practicing at your home using a backdrop of the Esplanade des Invalides, which is the venue for archery. Is that right?
Yeah. I believe that mental preparation is important. Once I found out where it was going to be, we actually flew over to bring awareness to the Paralympic Games a year or so out. And when I was over here, I went to the venue and I saw what it was. And I was able to mentally soak up all the noises and the sounds and the wind and the grass and the people. And then when I went home, I tried to create that in my house. So when I got here, it really felt like home.
And there are four armless archers at these games, the first time in history. It seems you've really opened doors in this sport, Matt. Can I even perhaps describe you as a mentor to the next generation of para athletes?
Archery has given me so much that it's kind of my way of giving back. And if I can help other armless archers feel how I felt, whether it's winning a medal or competing for their country, just that feeling alone gives them confidence in normal life stuff. And if I can give them that, how I feel and have felt at previous games and this games, then I want them to experience it. So I don't know if it's a mentorship really, but just taking them under my wing a little bit.
The Paralympic archer, Matt Stutzman. Now, royal weddings tend to follow a pretty predictable template. Grand church halls, carefully followed traditions, and centuries-old family values. But in Norway, they're doing things differently. Princess Martha Louise has just married her black American partner, Durek Verrett, and it's certainly ruffled a few feathers. He's a self-described shaman who says he's risen from the dead. Guests have been told to dress according to the theme, which is sexy and cool. Lena House is a Norwegian journalist who was outside the hotel where the wedding party took place, and she'd just spoken to the happy couple.
They were so happy. They were thanking all the people who showed up outside the hotel and greeting them as a newlywed couple. But Princess Martha Louise, she was not too happy with us in the press. She tends to dislike us a bit, and she was like, please get out of the way. I want to talk to the people, not the press.
And just tell us a little bit about the background to this wedding, because they both seem to be quite unusual characters.
Oh, they do. Yeah. So Princess Martha Louise is definitely one of the more unusual royal characters in Norway. When she was a bit younger, she told everyone that she was speaking to angels, and she made an angel school where she taught other people to speak to angels. And she called it like overly sensitive people who have the ability to talk to angels. Then she married the shaman Durek Verrett, who has made some pretty controversial saying. One thing he said is that he has a method that he can remove imprints from girls' vaginas so that you don't like to have the imprints of people you've had sex with. So some of his sayings are a bit controversial, and we write a lot about him here in Norway.
Yeah, I think he also sells a medallion that's supposed to cure cancer or something along those lines. So unusual couple. How is this marriage being seen by the people who, you know, she shoved the journalists out of the way and wanted to talk to them? Are they happy about this marriage?
I think it's a bit of both. You know, some people really like her. You know, she's very spiritual, and she's also a very good sportsman. She's a very good rider. She has been riding horses professionally. So some people really like her. But a lot of people also think she throws shade on the monarchy when she says what she says and she does what she does. And the whole wedding, the public hasn't been able to take part of it. They have closed the doors. So the only time the public have seen the newlyweds are, you know, when they went outside to say hello to them. Other than that, the public has had no part of the wedding.
The Norwegian journalist Lina House. Still to come.
What the danger might be is that people have what's called a disconfirmation of expectation response. So your brain's predicted, when I put a piece of that chocolate into my mouth, I'm going to get a rich orange flavour. And if it's not there, that is normally a bad thing.
The makers of Terry's Chocolate Orange provoke controversy among aficionados by offering a version without the orange flavour. The dispute between China and the Philippines over contested waters in the South China Sea has deepened over the last 2 years. Now, for the second time in 2 weeks, both sides have angrily blamed each other for the latest collision between their ships. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told Rachel Wright what happened.
It's a bit of a two-sided tale. The Chinese Coast Guard came out with a statement saying that a Philippine ship in the Sabina Shoal had deliberately crashed into a Chinese vessel. They were very clear that that's what had happened. But shortly after, Manila came out with almost a mirror copy of the story, saying that a Chinese ship had deliberately crashed into a Philippine ship. So they're just accusing each other of wrongdoing here. And it really is the second almost mirror incident in less than 2 weeks on the Sabina Shoal. Now, as you say, this is a really old dispute. What's important here, though, it's in a new location. The Sabina Shoal really before now wasn't of much interest. But just a few months ago, Philippine sailors discovered piles of crushed coral that they say China had been building up. They're very suspicious that they believe that China is trying to build a base there on this shoal, which they say is in Philippine water. So there are escalating worries that this really could lead to some kind of ongoing military dispute.
So how worried should we be if this is the second time in 2 weeks?
We should be concerned. I mean, the South China Sea itself is under dispute. China has claims to 90% of the sea, but we have a dispute with the Philippines. We've got disputes with Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, all claim parts of the sea. Also, the self-ruled island of Taiwan claims parts of the sea. The sea itself is incredibly important. It's home to mineral resources. About a third of global trade passes through the South China Sea. So we really need to be concerned that this latest dispute between China and the Philippines is heated up, but other countries are watching on anxiously.
Celia Hatton. Residents of Ukraine's second largest city are on high alert after Friday's attack by Russia, which killed a 14-year-old girl in a playground. Kharkiv, in the northeast of the country, has been the target of frequent assaults since Moscow's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Anastasia heard the sound of the missiles raining down while she was at home with her 2-year-old daughter. Lise Doucette asked her what was going through her mind during the latest attack.
I could clearly hear the moments of missiles hitting the ground and wherever they hit, which was quite loud despite all the noise of traffic and life going on. People are not getting tired. They are tired. They've been tired of it for many, many months already. It's just hard to draw this line between where you are just tired or whether you are just desperate or where you're angry. It's a mixture of lots of negative emotions put together.
You know, it's now more than 2 years that this has been going on. And as you say, you're living in a city which has been directly affected. Does it change people's view on the course of this war that, you know, calls to President Zelensky to end it politically if it can't be ended militarily? Does it have that impact?
When an attack like yesterday's comes along, thoughts like, let's call for peace talks, let's just sign some pact of non-attacking each other, all those thoughts, they are dismissed momentarily when you see the number of victims and casualties growing and growing. All you feel is a surge of anger rising from deep down within you, anger and some uncontrolled rage and despair. It is despair too. The word peace, it kind of gets erased from your even thoughts. All you think about is it safe to come outside now? What can I do? Is there anyone needing my help at the moment? This is what actually you think about.
Do you support the decision by President Zelensky and Ukrainian armed forces to focus their effort, their resources across the border to go into Russia's Kursk region?
I believe that if that helps to prevent further attacks on our settlements, on towns close to the border, my city included, with my heart, it gives me a sort of negatively pleasant feeling, maybe thinking that let them feel what it's like to have war come to their land, which is not, of course, the right thing to feel.
Anastasia speaking to Lise Doucette. Now, the Toronto International Film Festival starts this week, showcasing the best in global film. And one of those hoping to capture the attention of audiences is No Dress Rehearsal, a documentary shining a light on the band lauded as Canada's answer to the Beatles. The tragically hip, sometimes known as The Hip, have sold millions of records worldwide. But in 2016, frontman Gord Downie was diagnosed with a brain tumour. Megan Lawton has been speaking to his brother Mike, who directed the film.
Canada isn't immune to creating megastars, from Leonard Cohen and Shania Twain to Justin Bieber and Drake. But there's one band who have encapsulated their home country in a way other artists haven't, the Tragically Hip. First thing we climb a tree, and maybe then we'd... During a mammoth 33-year career, the band had 9 number one albums in Canada and became synonymous with the country through their lyrics and efforts to play its most remote towns and cities.
It takes forever to get out of Ontario. It takes 18 hours driving. We'd be leaving after the show and have to drive all night.
Paul Langlois played guitar in the band.
We felt that appreciation, especially like going to Newfoundland, a lot of bands, they have to cut that out. It's just too far.
I think they want another song, Paul.
In return for their efforts, Canadians bought to the band's music and showed up at their gigs. This dedication was amplified in 2016 when their lead singer, Gord Downie, was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer.
You're wonderful. Thank you for that.
The band's final gig was streamed by over 11 million people, a third of the population, making it one of Canada's most watched events. In the days after Gord's passing, venues around the nation dimmed their lights.
Last night, we lost a beloved frontman of our nation, a troubadour, storyteller, and courageous icon.
Hockey games paused to pay tribute, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wept on television.
Gord was my friend, but Gord was everyone's friend. It's who we were, our buddy Gord.
It's this journey of how a small town band became national treasures that's now the focus of a 4-part documentary, No Dress Rehearsal. It was directed by the late Gord Downie's brother, Mike Downie.
When it was wrapping up earlier this year, it made me sad because it had been a constant companion. Makes me emotional, actually, just thinking about that. Yeah, it made me miss my brother, made me appreciate him.
Despite being so well loved, the Tragically Hip are a band that outside of Canada, you might not be familiar with. This documentary explores why, starting with lead singer Gord's dedication to telling Canada's story, regardless of how well it played abroad.
Canada is kind of an enigmatic place when you say, what is it that makes a Canadian Canadian? Without being the cliches of maple syrup, and as Gordy would say, donuts and hockey sticks.
The result are songs like 50 Mission Cap, which tells the true story of Bill Barilko, a Canadian ice hockey player who died when his plane mysteriously disappeared. And Wheat Kings, a song about David Milgaard, a Canadian man who served 23 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Wait and see
what tomorrow brings. There was just this sense in the audience of like, oh wow, you're singing about us. Like, this is our moment.
So often with artists, the goal is to break America, but that wasn't top of the Hips list. But as No Dress Rehearsal makes clear, the band chose their own road to the States in a way that was authentic to them.
We played all the best rooms, certainly in America and certainly in Europe. I mean, we felt those successes and we were proud of them because it was kind of like we were on our own.
Despite going on to play Glastonbury and open for the Rolling Stones, the Hips music was mostly appreciated back home. But this documentary could change that and introduce the band to new fans.
That report by Megan Lawton at the Toronto Film Festival runs from Friday the 6th of September to Sunday the 15th. As you probably know, companies love to tinker with their products. Remember green ketchup or perhaps new Coke? That one lasted only 80 days. Well, now the chocolatier Terry's, founded in England in 1767, is about to launch an update to an old favourite.
You know, I'm the caring, sharing type. I mean, just the other night I caught myself thinking, wouldn't it be nice to share this delicious Terry's chocolate orange with some of my dearest chums? And then I thought, no, actually. No.
Terry's chocolate orange.
It's not Terry's. It's mine.
Yeah, well, now the company wants to introduce us to the delights of a chocolate orange without the orange. And some people believe that our memories will still make us taste orange, even if it isn't there. Sean Lay has been discussing this phenomenon with the experimental psychologist Charles Spence.
Most people come to know and love and expect a Terry's chocolate orange that looks like an orange, that is orange-coloured, to have an orange flavour. And hence, with this new variant that doesn't have the orange flavour, what the danger might be is that people have what's called a disconfirmation of expectation response, where you're so convinced your brain's predicted, when I put a piece of that chocolate into my mouth, I'm going to get a rich chocolatey flavour. And if it's not there, then our brain has got it wrong. And that is normally a bad thing. And hence we like things less very often when our brain's got the predictions the wrong way around.
Now, the chocolate orange, or what's going to be called the milk chocolate ball that's being experimented, doesn't really have the same catchy sound, does it? It's not going to be wrapped in an orange foil. So might that help with what our senses are picking up when they look at this thing?
If you're coming out with a not orange-flavoured chocolate orange, then your packaging, I don't know, you might think, well, white's the thing to go with because it's got no orange flavour, or maybe black to make it look luxurious. But in fact, they seem to have gone with blue packaging. And to me, that's very interesting because blue is one of the colours where we don't really have many strong expectations of what blue things should taste like. And hence, it's an effective way to introduce new flavours into the marketplace, colour them blue. So when people first see it, they don't know what to expect. And hence, that can sometimes help to alleviate or prevent this disconfirmation of expectation response that makes things taste bad.
We talked about orange in terms of the chocolate orange. I've also got here some Smarties. I've got red one, green, pinky purple, yellow, orange. Am I right in saying the orange ones only have an orange flavour in the UK and some other countries, and there are some countries where they don't like the orange flavour? What's that about?
We did an experiment where we had people and gave them different colours of Smarties, the orange ones and the brown ones in particular, and asked them about the taste of other colours like the green one. And what was amazing is that people have some very strong beliefs about the flavour. They say, you know, that the green ones taste limey, that the red ones taste sweeter, that the brown Smarties taste chocolatier, and that the orange ones really do taste of orange. But in fact, the only ones that might taste of the colour of their casing are the orange ones. And as you say, in the UK, the orange Smarties really do have some orange flavouring, whereas in Germany and many other countries, they don't. And people, when we gave them these orange-looking but not orange-flavoured Smarties, many people, you know, still thought they tasted of orange, even though they did not. So there's kind of expectations that built up, both from the colour of foods, but also in the case of, I guess, the chocolate orange, it's the fact that it's an orange shape and it comes out as segments that look like orange segments are all setting these strong expectations about what the taste or flavour should be.
I get why the chocolate orange sends a signal to the brain about what it might be like because of the shape, the fact it's in segments like an orange is. It's all pointing in the same direction. But here's another example. I'm just going to open the box and there's foil wrapping underneath. Now, this is a Toblerone. The shape of the Toblerone, very different from the chocolate orange. Does the shape affect our perception of what it's going to taste like?
So these are semantically meaningful shapes, like a segment of orange, but also more primitive than that. People associate sweet-tasting things with round shapes and angular shapes with bitter-tasting foods. And then when you taste, sometimes those angular-shaped chocolates do taste more bitter to you than exactly the same formulation of chocolate when we present it as a sphere or another kind of round shape instead.
Is anyone else just really hungry now? That was the psychologist Charles Spence. And that's all from us for now. There will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you'd like to comment on the topics that we're covering, do send us an email. Our address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Darren Garrett. The producer was Nikki Verrico, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Chris Barrow. Until next time, goodbye.